the June 20th Astoria City Council meeting.
The mic. Use the mic.
You can't, oh, Lord mercy, I knew I'd screw up. That's just the first one, though. I've got lots of better ones coming. Ms. Cosby, would you call the roll, please?
Sure. Counselor Herzig.
Here.
Counselor Price.
Here.
Mayor Pro, acting.
Mayor Pro Tem. We also have Counselor Nimmelwell on the phone.
Oh, Counselor Nimmelwell.
I'm here.
And official title tonight is?
Would be Mayor Pro Tem.
Mayor Pro Tem Ward.
That sounds really pretentious. Could we just say Russ or something? Here. Mr. Estes, have there been any changes to the agenda?
There will be one change to the agenda. There'll be a request for an additional item, which is for authorization to solicit proposals for a fuel system replacement. And we'd like to be able to have that as item 7D if possible.
I have no objection. And could we have reports of counselors? Can we start with Counselor Nimmelwell?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Hear you fine.
Okay, great. Well, I am in Salt Lake City right now for a family wedding. And I was traveling during our last meeting due to a work conference. And unfortunately, I was unable to call in because of flight delays. So I'd like to apologize for that, and thank you, Councilor Bork, for running the meeting tonight. You know, I'd like to mention John Burden, the founder and CEO of Craft 3. He was a mentor and friend of mine, and he just did so much to capitalize the Astoria Renaissance. I'd like to acknowledge his work and express my deepest condolences to his family and colleagues at Craft 3. Also, our city's maintenance supervisor, Jonah Dart McLean from Parks and Rec, I hear such good feedback about him, not only from his boss, but from members of the community. It's a very tough position right now with the vast properties and facilities that our Parks Department manages. And I think that Jonah deserves praise for holding it all together right now. I'd also like to thank the amazing citizens on the Parks and Rec Master Plan Committee. Each individual brought a really important perspective, and my hope is that the Parks Master Plan will eventually ease some of the challenges of the Parks Department. And also, the Clatsop Community College Historic Preservation instructors and students did an amazing, impressive job leveraging a fairly small amount of grant funds to do just a world-class job restoring the century-old stained glass windows at the mausoleum that resides on the city's Ocean View Cemetery property. I hope that we can work with them more in the future. And I think they deserve a lot of gratitude, and I really appreciate their work. And that is my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Nimmelwell. Councilor Herzig.
Thank you, Councilor Ward. I participated in a Red Cross shelter training this last weekend. The First United Methodist Church is a designated Red Cross shelter. And we went through not a simulation, but basically what would happen if they did happen to open a shelter there. So we walked through the intake process, dormitory, meals, that sort of thing. Interestingly, the shelter is here in Astoria, but the trailer that carries all the shelter supplies is parked in Warrenton. So that might be an issue. So they're going to be trying to figure out if they can get that trailer. I suggested possibly at the middle school, where I know that there are other caches being organized. So hopefully we will get the trailer with the supplies and the actual shelter location itself in the same city soon. This coming weekend, on Friday, I'm participating in the library's After Hours program. We're going to be talking about how our cultural attitude towards women informs our attitude toward our LGBTQ population. So it seems very topical. And that's going to be at 6 p.m. at the library, and it's free to the public. And then on Saturday at noon, I'll be doing another Meet the Counselor, also at the library in the flag room. So Friday night, 6 o'clock, talking about misogyny and transphobia, to use the two big words. And then at noon on Saturday, just meet me live. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Herzog and Councilor Price.
Thank you. Well, I would like to thank the 2 out of 3 people who joined me at the Salon Cult this weekend. It was, thank you, they're both here in the audience tonight, and it was the worst timing possible. There was the Lower Columbia Preservation Society meeting, the Scandinavian Festival, the Astoria Music Festival, and a few other things, all of which I attended at least for a few minutes, but thanks for coming. And second, very much the fine words of appreciation that Councilor Nemuel gave. These are all important people and organizations in our society, and I will certainly miss John Curtis.
That's the end of your report. Thank you. I have no real report, but I also would like to speak a little bit about John Burgess. He was amazing in the dealings that I was privy to. He could find solutions where there just weren't any. And he was a great asset to our community and to Craft 3. Would it be appropriate to have a moment of silence in his honor? Can we do that? Okay, the next items on the agenda are 2 presentations. The first is Ocean View Cemetery new GIS online system. I've been able to use it in my business. It's pretty remarkable. It's making life easier for me. I don't know about the rest of you, but go ahead.
Thank you for having us here tonight. Joining me tonight to point out a few people are Recreation Coordinator Tara Patterson, Kaylee, one of our part-time employees, and then a wonderful volunteer, Jan Miltenberger, is here. But I'm going to take you back a few years to the fall of 2013. We stood in front of you and asked to do a request for proposals to have a GIS system for Ocean View Cemetery. And the goal was to improve the functionality and management of the cemetery and be able to help loved ones who are going to visit folks who have already been interned at the cemetery have better ease in identifying where they are buried. And then additionally, it said allow better access for staff to be able to identify which plots are open for sale and identify who is buried where, provide a lot better ease in management. So we proceeded with that process and came back then in January 2014 with a contract for approval to council. And council blessed that contract. We moved forward with contractor Mark Scott, who created a system entirely for us based off of Ocean View Cemetery, as well as all of our records that we currently have. Some of these records were able to be scanned into the system, and then some of them, most of them, had to be entered by hand. And that's where Kaylee and Jan came in very heavily. At the time, we talked to council about how this would be a very manual process and we'd rely on part-time labor and volunteer assistance, like most of our department runs for our programs. So the process began, the system was created, the entire cemetery was mapped out, and a very large Excel spreadsheet was created that actually includes all rows of 19,431 rows for every burial that has taken place. And for every row, there's 51 facts that needs to be entered about each burial. So in total, that gave us just under 1 million data points that were largely entered manually. So tonight, we wanted to take a minute to say thank you to the wonderful staff who put it together and volunteers who helped put it together, as well as give you a little demo of how the process works. So I'll pass it off to Tara, who will show you from our Parks and Recreation website, astoriaparks.com, how to get to the GIS system.
All right. So we, as Angela mentioned, have about 19,000 different records at the cemetery. And that can be a little bit difficult to navigate, but the system works great for that. There's a few different ways you can actually get into the map. The one that Angela has up here on the website is the most common one. And so you can just click here to view details, and that'll take you right to the link to the grave locator and maps. So this gets us into our map. It likes to scan into the center of the grave or of the cemetery itself. But as you can see, you can scan out and you can see the entire cemetery. The cemetery, for those of you who aren't aware, is segregated or sectioned into different blocks, which are what the big green numbers are. If you scan in on the big green numbers, it's also broken down by lots within, and then further it's broken down by these little letters that indicate individual plots. So if you were looking for a particular person, and I let's say I want to find a gentleman by the name of Russell Olson. Olson is actually a very popular last name, one of the reasons why I picked him. I can come over here for my name search, and if I type in Olson, I'm going to find a lot of Olsons. So, yeah, there we go. So this will, I can scroll down and I can look through each record for Russell. There's a couple other ways I can do it that might quicken my search a little bit. So I can search by where he was born, and I happen to know that he was born in Spokane, Washington. So then this will break down for me everybody who was born in Spokane, Washington. I don't have my glasses on, but I believe he was the third one. There he is. So I, now that I've found him this way, I can also come in here and I can locate him on the map. But I'm going to show you one other way to find him, because there's a few different ways to find each person. If, for example, I didn't know where he was born, I can also put in his date of death, and that will also bring it up. And down here below, it gives you an example of how to put the numbers in so that it's easier to, well, so that the system likes the numbers. So as you can see, it has it broken down for us that way. And that will pull him up without any searching through different records. So obviously the dates, you know, those are super helpful. Again, once I've done that, I can click on this little button right here and it takes me right to this plot. Our system also has the ability to give you directions now that you've found the place you want to go. And we can also pull those up. Additionally, there's a couple other cool little features on here. It will show us grave permit. We can search by grave permit number if we know that. And then we can also bookmark individual graves. Questions do you guys have?
No questions from the audience. They don't plan on being out there.
For those of you who've tried to find the grave, this is actually pretty exciting because it does take some doing otherwise.
It was a very long project and very complicated. And since my business is associated with that, it's a really good tool for us, but it's also a very good tool for people coming from out of the area who are trying to find loved ones or their grave location. So thanks very much, Tara.
I skipped over it slightly at the beginning, but the materials I put up here were the formerly what we have to search through to be able to find where those burials were. So
they remember these,
right? And they know the books.
Yeah. having the old records?
Yes.
Or having the old?
We'll be finding a safe spot to archive them, likely probably in the city hall basement or possibly the library.
Thank you to the volunteers for all. I can't imagine anything more numbing than to enter over the library.
Thank you. Our next presentation is having to do with Bear Creek Dam seismic study results, and Brett, go ahead and give us a little explanation of what's going on.
Sure. I'm going to ask Jeff Harrington, our city engineer, to come forward and make some introductions, but over the past few years, the city's been conducting engineering studies on the Bear Creek Dam at the Astoria watershed. And representatives from the consulting team who have been conducting this analysis will be here tonight to make a presentation on what they found. But Jeff, I'm going to have you make those introductions if you don't mind.
Okay. We have Jerry Heslin from Cornforth Associates who will be speaking about the study, and he's the one that was in the lead, his team that did the analysis. And then Keith Mills, who's the State Oregon Water Resource Department engineer, and Keith's been very generous with helping us with grant funding for this project. In the previous memos that we provided to council, in this one here, also the summary of the cost. So we've spent $390,000 to date on this study, and $153,000 of it was through grants, which was a really good contribution. Some of the phases they made half the cost. So while Jerry's getting set up here, I'll give a little background. The Bear Creek Dam is currently 90 feet high. It's a concrete, what they call a gravity dam. It was originally built to a height of 75 feet in 1912, and then it was added on to in 1953, 15 feet to bring it to a 90-foot height. The dam is considered by the State Water Resource Department to be a high hazard dam, and that means in the event of its failure, it could lead to the loss of life and or property downstream. That's always been the concern. We had a study done in 1993 by a firm, and what we've always thought from those studies, they did a study that wasn't nearly in depth is much depth as the study that we just did. Things were done a little differently back then, and I'm sure budget limitations led them to do a little less of a job than they wish they probably could have. But the results of that study were indicated that the dam could fail and probably should fail, especially in an earthquake. And everybody kind of knew the things that we've been hearing is that can't be true. It's a very stout dam, it's built very well. And as you'll hear tonight, there's some truth to that, and now we have some proof to that. So the project that's currently just being completed went in three phases. We did a geotechnical investigation, which is all the soils analysis to start. Then they did a structural and seismic analysis that led them to discover that they needed a little more information on a particular side of the dam that there was inadequate soil information. So instead of leaving a loose end, we got additional funding and did that study. The Colorado School of Mines, is that true, was involved with some of the studies, some testing of the material. And Jerry will get into the details, but it was found that the dam was founded in some very good basalt material, and the strength of the concrete is much higher than anybody anticipated. So I'll let him share the good news, but first I'm going to let Keith speak for a minute. He wanted to just talk. He hasn't really had the opportunity to speak in any of the previous presentations.
Mayor Pro Tem Moore and members of council, I'm the state engineer for water resources, so we're responsible for the safety of about 930 dams around the state. And this is one that has been of concern. And the big concern is that we were fairly close to the Cascadia subduction zone, and the previous engineering report concluded that something like, by the laws of physics, that dam shouldn't be there, but it has been there for over 100 years. So in reading that report, we did not have enough information to determine the stability, and the previous report said it was unstable. So we had a special emergency action plan for this dam that Jeff worked very hard on, and we met with the residents of Swinson to go over what to do in an emergency, and then high priority was to really figure out what the risk was at that dam. And so we worked closely with the city and with Jeff to pick a qualified consultant and do a really thorough analysis of the dam, so we could say with reasonable certainty how well your water supply is going to hold up in pretty severe conditions. So that's, you know, Jeff covered everything else, so I think Jerry Heslin from Cornforth Consultants is going to really go over that analysis that they did.
Keith, thank you for that. But our minutes are taken by recording, and so they can get the minutes right. Would you give us your name and address?
Keith Mills, State Engineer for Water Resources, Oregon Water Resources Department, 725 Summer Street Northeast, Salem, Oregon, 97301.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you. So I'm Jerry Heslin with Cornforth Consultants, and I've been kind of leading up the seismic stability evaluation for Bear Creek Dam. And I'm here tonight to just kind of wrap things up, tell you what we did, what we found, and what I see moving forward. And for those of y'all who were here in October when I came and gave you an update, a lot of this is gonna look similar, but we'll go over it for the sake of being thorough. Page down for me, please. This is what I'd like to cover tonight, and if at any point you guys have a question, feel free to interrupt. We'll make this free form. I'll start with some background about the project, revisit the project objectives from our aspect of the work, present a geologic model that we built to better understand the structure, go over some of the analysis methods and the results, and then finish up with the conclusions. Page down for me, please. So, like Keith and Jeff said, this structure has been analyzed on two previous occasions, and unfortunately, both of those studies concluded that the dam was not stable in an earthquake, and they recommended some downstream buttresses to help that. And those were good studies, but they were based on a very simplified model of the dam. And so it seemed like they were oversimplified, so we were retained to kind of take a fresh look, go back to the beginning, and make sure all the assumptions that were made were good assumptions. The first step in our process to getting to that end result was to build the geologic model of the dam. Like I said, they used a simplified model previously, and the biggest simplifying assumptions that they made was they said, let's ignore the abutments and just focus on the center, the maximum height section of the dam. The way we were going to get past that shortcoming was to use some information that Ken rescued from the archives. It's the field engineer's notebook from 1911. And we decided to use that information to understand the structure better. And with that understanding of the structure, our primary objective was to evaluate the sliding stability of the dam. And again, our biggest charge is to capture the resistance in the abutments. Page down for me, please. So this is a picture of the downstream face of Bear Creek Dam, and I think this picture really shows you how narrow the canyon is. And those slopes on the left and the right are very hard, very strong basalt that the previous analyses ignored. And really the portion of the dam that they focused on is really only about 30 feet wide at the base of the canyon. Page down for me, please. So to start building the geologic model, we started with the big picture. Really the words and the lines on this aren't terribly important. What's important for this presentation is the colors. The pink areas are hardened, very strong basalt, and really everything else is much weaker marine sediments, siltstones, sandstones. So page down for me, please. Bear Creek Dam is located right there, and it's difficult to see on this screen, but that is on a pink rock. And basically what we have is a big hunk of competent basalt floating in a sea of much weaker marine sediments. And what that means for us is that the foundation conditions change drastically, and they change quickly, because the size of the piece of basalt is on the order of the same size as the dam itself. So with that understanding, our next charge was to figure out how the structure fits into that environment. Page down for me, please. So at this point, I'm gonna switch over to a different part of the presentation. Last time. So let's see. So basically, the important part of that presentation was the resident engineer from 1911 drew cross sections of the dam every 5 or 10 feet. And that gave us a very good idea not only what the superstructure looked like, but it let us know what was under the dam. And what we learned from that is that the left abutment is sitting on very strong basalt, the right abutment is sitting on very strong basalt, but the center section, where both of the previous studies were focused, is on a much weaker sandstone. And we think the reason it is the way it is because when they were excavating for construction of the dam, they basically dug right through the bottom of the basalt into that sea of marine sediments. Okay, so why don't you page down for me? So what we learned from the model was that the left side of the dam is on very strong basalt, and it's embedded into that basalt quite well. The center section is on a weaker sandstone that is not embedded very well. And the right abutment is on strong basalt, but it's not embedded nearly as well as the left abutment. And what I'm terming the far right abutment, and that is the portion of the dam at the extreme right abutment on the outside of this prominent vertical crack that occurred when the dam was raised in the 50s. That portion of the dam is the only portion that's on soil. So, page down for me.
Excuse me, are you saying as you face the dam right and left?
As we're looking downstream.
Okay, so above the dam face, yep. In the water area.
Yeah. Correct.
There's also another question.
Well, that was it. The right abutment would be the one closest to the house.
Correct. So once we had an understanding of the geologic environment and the structure, that really let us get going about our business of analyzing the stability, and we just kind of chopped the dam up into representative pieces so we could do analysis on the pieces and then put the pieces back together at the end. And you see here in the center is the yellow section. That is the tallest portion of the dam, and that's the portion that's on the weakest foundation material. And that's where both of the previous studies were focused. So tallest section of the dam, weakest foundation material, really bad results. However, if you move to the left and the right of that, you start benefiting from the dam getting shorter and the foundation conditions getting much better and being embedded into those the basalt bedrock much better. Page down for me, please. I'll go through this really quickly. This is the center section of the dam. Basically, it's a fairly simple problem. We have a hunk of concrete sitting on sandstone, and page down for me. And we just look at a trial failure surface like this and determine the total amount of resistance that we have on that surface. So if we move to the left and the right, page down for me, the situation is a little more complicated because the dam is smaller. It's sitting up in this much stronger basalt, but we have that weak layer down below. We go about the problem in the same way. We just do it multiple times. So page down for me. And again, and again, and again. We look at multiple failure surfaces, find the one that matters, and then for that one, we calculate the total amount of resistance that we have. So can you page down for me again? So this is a view of the downstream part of the dam, and those analysis sections that I was just showing you are the red lines. And basically what we're doing is we're calculating the stability at the red lines. And if one of those analysis sections doesn't have good stability, say like the center section, one of its neighbors can help it, can help support that center section. And that's really the key to this approach, is developing this composite factor of safety. And what we did is, for the portion of the dam between the two prominent vertical cracks, which are on the right and the left extremes of that photo, we combine all those analyses into a composite factor safety, where the sections can help each other. For the portions on the outside of those prominent vertical cracks, which I'm terming the far left and far right abutments, we just calculate those in the normal way individually. Page down for me, please. And so what I've summarized here are the calculated factors of safety for the far left abutment, the center section of the dam, the bulk of the dam, and the far right abutment. And typically the numbers we're looking for in these columns are under static conditions, anything greater than 1.5, and in seismic conditions, anything greater than 1.1. For the far left abutment, the part that's very short and sitting in strong basalt, we're far, far above those numbers. So if we move out into the center section of the dam, the portion between the prominent vertical cracks, again, we're well in exceeding 1.5 and 1.1, which is good news. When we move to the far right abutment, the portion that's on soil.
I'm going to have to be the blonde at the table and say I don't get it. What does it mean the seismic is, what is the composite factor of safety? If you said it, I didn't get it.
Okay, so the factor of safety is something that we in the engineering world use to quantify how stable something is. It's a ratio of the resisting force to the driving force, more or less. So.
And so what's the number that you're looking for that is good?
For static conditions, with the dam just sitting there, I want to see something greater than 1.5.
Okay, and for seismic?
I want to see something greater than 1.1. So when we move to the far right abutment, the portion that's sitting on soil, we're in good shape statically. Seismically, we're dropping below 1, which means it's not stable. However, if we go into a displacement analysis, we calculate that that's going to move about a tenth of an inch. So page down for me, please. So just to kind of wrap up everything that we've done, this, for static conditions, everything's greater than 2.5. And since 2.5 is greater than 1.5, we're good. Under seismic conditions, most of the dam is greater than 1.5. 1.5 is greater than 1.1, so we're good there too. The far right abutment is a little lower in the seismic event, but it's not going to move a meaningful amount, so we're good there too. To wrap it all up, all of these factors of safety and displacements are well within the tolerable limits, so we don't think there's any additional geotech analysis needed for stability.
And Jerry, just one other question. For the seismic event, are you looking at a 9.0 there?
Yeah.
There.
We're looking at an earthquake from the Cascadia subduction zone.
Right. And so did you extrapolate like a lesser amount of shaking there because it's further in and up?
Yes.
So it would be maybe a 7 there?
Well, the earthquake magnitude is the earthquake magnitude.
Okay.
So that's measured at the source. So the level of shaking at the site, we attenuated the ground motions from the source to the site.
I have some questions. So the results indicate that you assume the dam structure itself will stay in one piece. Is that correct?
Yes. It will stay in one piece, and it will stay where it's sitting.
Do we know it won't crack? Do we know? I mean, everybody's vision of a dam and an earthquake is it opens like the Red Sea and waters pour out. You're saying it's just going to be one piece and it's not going anywhere significant.
Correct.
And that's based on science. All right.
The way this dam works is it relies on its own weight for stability. So it can't open like a gate, like you, your hand gestures.
I'm saying that shaking the structure of the dam itself, if there are cracks on either far right and far left, I mean, there won't be any more cracks during the Cascadia event. It might possibly weaken the structure where the water pressure would push it down.
I would say it could crack more, but you know, what our study is focused on is a catastrophic failure of the dam and an uncontrolled release of the reservoir.
All right.
And our calculations show that it's happens. That's not going to happen.
All right, thank you. Jerry, that's good news. Thank you very much.
You bet.
So after 20 years of people stressing about this, we have good news finally. It's great. We don't have to worry about a failure of the dam. What we do have to worry about is one of the assumptions is that the abutments are holding the dam in place. So if those abutments get damaged, that could affect the stability of the dam. So one of the things that we're going to be doing in the future to protect the abutments, and what damages the abutments is what's called overtopping of the dam. When the floodwaters come up so high and pour over the top of the dam. Talking to staff, there's only record of it happening once, and it happened in a pretty controlled manner because we have a spillway with some curbing that keeps the water in the middle of the dam. What we're going to do to prevent the risk of that happening is we're going to repair the valve that drains the dam so that, like other dams, in an emergency, when the dam is running at a high level and there's a very large storm event coming, you can lower the dam a little bit to build yourself a little buffer like they do in Bonneville and the other dams for what they call flood management. So that project has been budgeted this fiscal year. It's $30,000, and we will be coming to you with a request to authorize a contract for that work. And then the fiscal year after this coming one, we're going to budget a study, which is called a peak or probable maximum flow, and that'll be a study of the largest flood event that can come down. It'll factor in all the latest and greatest information that the Department of Climatology has, including climate change, all that kind of stuff. So once again, it'll be based off better science than some of these older studies. And as a matter of fact, we're waiting on that study because the guidelines that the federal government has established, it's FEMA establishes that?
NOAA.
Oh, NOAA. NOAA, the state's waiting for the new guidelines to come out before they ask us to proceed with that study. And once that's done, that'll give us guidance onto what we might want to do for an auxiliary spillway, which has always been planned for the project. It's been talked about for a lot of years, but off to the east side of the reservoir, there's already kind of a natural low area south of the house, and that would be our auxiliary spillway. It would be concrete lined and designed to allow the water to spill out to the east before it went over the top of the dam. So that'll be a few years out. Those two things in place, it's a pretty fail-safe situation. Any more questions?
I've got none. How about you?
Yes, I did just have a couple of other questions. Well, does this report have any effect on the insurance either of the city or the residents below the dam? And does it have any effect on the emergency notification procedures that might currently be in place?
That's a great question, and we have a Keith had mentioned the emergency action plan that we had prepared a few years ago, and we gave a presentation at the Swenson Range about that. This will affect that. We were just talking before this meeting about how that will affect it. When that report or that plan is required to be updated once a year, we just got finished updating it about 2 months ago. So we're going to on the next cycle. We'll probably start working on it now, but on the next cycle, we will have added these changes into there. I also plan to, and then the changes are going to be in that plan. There's multiple modes of failure. There's flood event. There's the earthquake. So this is the earthquake scenario. The earthquake scenario was the number one concern in that plan, and it was a tough one. We've had a lot of meetings and a lot of discussion with staff about it because we didn't know who was going to be where when this event happened, who's going to take the chance of driving through the inundation zone to go check the dam if nobody's up there, things like that. And this is all assuming that we might lose radio communications or other communications. So this study alleviates that concern. So what we'll do is we'll take that earthquake event. It's still going to be something we need to do. We still want to go check it for cracks, like we were talking about earlier, and things like that. So what we'll do is we'll just take that from the number one priority emergency event and lower it down, probably to one of the lower ones. And then the first, the new one will become a flood event. And that's where these flood studies come into play. Now, as far as the people downstream, I know talking to people in the community out there that they were not happy about the public information coming out. We talked about putting signs in the inundation zone and how would that affect me trying to sell my property with a sign next to my, you know, property that says, you know, you're entering this flood inundation zone. So anyways, this alleviates that. We don't need signs. There's no need for that. There's no need for concern. And I'll present that information to them at the Swenson Grange View for the senior center.
Yeah. Well, you'll have a conversation about that, but I think that just from what we've been told right now, I would be cautious about lowering it too low, this priority of the earthquake or the seismic event or the signage, because we've just heard that there's still some uncertainty about the basalt that the bridge abutments go into and what might happen to that during the seismic event, which would maybe keep the dam intact, but have some serious failures. We just don't know. So signage seems like an easy, cautious way to go. But I leave it to you for the discussions.
Yeah, with all the things that are going to happen in an emergency, you know, we try to focus on the most important ones, and you know, we don't want to create any climate of fear. We want people to understand what the priorities are, and if that's less of a concern, then you know, I wouldn't want somebody to panic and get hurt trying to evacuate if there's no need to do that. But it still would be wise to move to higher ground after an earthquake.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Council, I do see some people here from maybe from that area. Should we see if there's any comments for
them? I've got Jack Kidd. Does anyone want to speak to us about
Thank you.
No, apparently not.
Yeah.
Well, I got it.
Jeff. Jeff? If you would please come in, there's a citizen who has a question. And also the consultants are probably here as well.
Should I ask it up here?
Sure.
Chris Ferrar, 3023 Harrison Avenue, Astoria. I was just curious when you showed the data about the factor of safety of the various segments of the dam. It was just divided into three sections. There was kind of a left embankment, a right embankment, and the middle. So that middle, I'm assuming that number represents an average over that entire width. I don't know if it's a geometric average or what you use, but my question is, what is the worst point in that dam, 1 foot wide? What's the seismic safety factor on that minimum width? Because that's where it'll fail. So I wonder if you have that information. Thank you.
I'll try to answer that and let Jerry add in if he needs to. But one of the things that just kind of flashed in my mind that Jerry didn't do too much depth on was a component of this study was the structural study. And what they did is they we dug up the as-builts for the dam that showed every piece of rebar in that dam, and they also did a lot of concrete testing. So, for example, when we build something new today and specify sidewalk or concrete for something, we're looking for a specified strength of 3,000 pounds per square inch, 3,000 PSI. Some of these concrete samples came in at 9,000. The lowest was 9,000 PSI, then about 4,000,
something like that.
And that depended on the type of rock. So what they found was that there was some very, in the original dam, there was some very strong rock in the concrete mix. One of the things that, in my research, I found from the state of Oregon, the Department of Transportation, is some of the problems they're having with their bridges on the coast is the fact that beach sand was used, and the salt in the sand damages the steel in the structures. There's no salt in this concrete. This was very, very good concrete for that time, so the guys knew what they were doing. And basically what that led up to with all that steel, with the size of the dam, is it acts as a monolith. It acts as a beam. It can't just break and crack like a 2x4 wood or something. It's a very large mass. So when they did that composite factor of safety, they had the assumption that those forces, that resisting force, would be transferred into the rest of the structure up to the point of the cracks. So is there any more you would add to that? Does that answer the question adequately?
Thank you, Jim.
Mr. Farrar, did that answer your question?
I'm very dubious, but that's their answer.
Okay, thank you. Right, we're good. Thanks again. Okay, next item on the agenda is the consent calendar. The items on the consent calendar are considered routine and will be adopted by one motion unless a member of the City Council requests to have an item considered separately. Members of the community may have an item removed if they contact the city manager by 5 o'clock the day of the meeting. Did that happen at all?
There were no requests from the community.
Is there any request from the council?
I would like item 6C1 removed, please.
Item 6C?
One, yes.
One, Historic Landmarks Commission meeting. I'll entertain a motion to accept items 6, A, B, D, and E.
So moved.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. May we have a roll call, please? Mr. Cook?
Councilor Herzig?
Aye.
Councilor Demelow?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Ward?
Aye. Thanks for speaking up, Councilor Demelow. I'd forgotten you were here. Okay. Historic Landmarks Commission meeting 5/17/16.
Yes, thank you. This is on page 26 of our packet. This is item 7C, the tiny house revolution. And it says, staff has partnered with a tiny home builder in Hammond who will temporarily place a home on city-owned property in downtown Astoria. Can we get an update on that? That sounds really nice.
I don't have an update on that project, unfortunately. There hasn't been any movement since that meeting.
But that's something to look forward to, that we're going to have a tiny home demo somewhere kind of thing, just as part of our search for creating more housing. So I was excited to read that. So I just wanted to see what the status was. Thank you.
Okay, we need to...
I move that we accept agenda item 6C1.
Second.
Second.
All in favor? We can do this with just a motion, can't we? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. So then motion carries. Next item are the regular agenda items. All agenda items are open for public comment following deliberation by the City Council. Rather than asking for public comment after each agenda item, the mayor asks the audience members raise their hands if they want to speak about any item, and they will be recognized. In order to respect everyone's time, please have your comments limited to 3 minutes or less. And first item is a public hearing and resolution adopting a supplemental budget for fiscal year 2015-16.
So I'll give a report about this item, and then Mayor Pro Tem Moore will need to open up a public hearing to accept any comment before any deliberation on the resolution. So Oregon Revised Statutes provides a procedure for a municipality to pass a supplemental budget that adjusts for changes that happen during a fiscal year. And we're approaching the end of our fiscal year. Our fiscal year starts July 1st and runs through June. And there are several items requiring a supplemental budget this year. And this is for the council may recall that these types of items happen at the end of each fiscal year to be able to address any of these issues in advance of the end of the fiscal year to be able to have things on track when the audit services get going in July. For the general fund, this supplemental budget would, first of all, increase the Community Development Department requirements by a total of $15,000, and would also create an inter-fund transfer not to exceed $290,000 for the Parks and Operation Funds. The Community Development Department transfer is required as a result of extra labor which was required in providing coverage for the planner position, which was vacant for a good part of this year, and also for the ability for then our new Community Development Director, Kevin Cronin, to be able to get up to speed with regards to that department. And these services were provided by Mike Morgan as the interim planner and former planner, Rosemary Johnson. She was also, I note, Ms. Johnson was wrapping up several projects for the department, including some of the vision plan implementation work that was ongoing. With regards to the Parks Operation Fund, there is a need for increased resources, recognizing a $290,000 transfer from the general fund. There were increased requirements for the Aquatic Center, and these anticipated expenses were projected to exceed approved budget amounts by $75,000. This includes wages that were needed to be able to cover the increased wages designed to attract and retain qualified staff when we had the issue where we were not able to hire lifeguards with the wage that was being paid at the time. The remainder is a result of the Aquatic Center coordinator's departure in mid-May and the need to be able to cash out those vacation accounts after she left. There are non-labor expenses that are associated with repair and maintenance of this facility above and beyond what was budgeted. Also, with regards to the Recreation Division, there were anticipated expenses in the amount of $200,000. A portion of this comes from the use of Rosemary Johnson and John Gutenberger to complete necessary background and title research and develop history of the parks in conjunction with the Parks Master Plan. One of the things that came up during the development of the Parks Master Plan was the council's desire to understand the possibility of the ability to divest certain parks if they felt that was appropriate to be able to reduce expenditures on maintenance, and that work was completed as a part of the master plan in an amount above what was budgeted. Also, there were also additional expenses within the recreation department to be able to provide the general functions of the department throughout the year. There were non-labor expenses in an amount not to exceed $50,000. This includes, you may recall, the late renewal, the grade school rental agreement, which had two payments of leases this current year. The appropriation authority level of an additional $15,000 is included in the supplemental budget to provide for any unanticipated items. And this is requested in that we have a couple more weeks left within this fiscal year. We're having to come up with the best projection as we have right as we can to try and avoid coming back to the council after the end of the fiscal year to do a final wrap up. I would note that also in the Capital Improvement Fund, there are increased resources in the amount of $22,500 for unanticipated revenue. Council may recall at the last meeting the presentation of the check, if you want to call it, $1,028,000 for the carbon credits. And also, there was a additional requirements to be able to provide consultant services to be able to receive those funds. Rather than include the entire $1,028,000 in this year's budget, what has been proposed is to include an amount of that deposit in the amount of the additional expenses which were required, which was $22,500. That's what the revenue is being included in this budget, while the remaining $1 million will be shown as a beginning fund balance in the next fiscal year. There was some question about that a little bit earlier. So the only thing that's being realized this current fiscal year is what is needed to be able to cover the consultant services. So tonight's recommend that the council conduct the public hearing and consider the resolution for the supplemental budget.
Okay, and I would like to open a public hearing to take first public comment having to do with the supplemental budget. Is there anyone wanting to speak against? Is there anyone wanting to speak for? Yes.
The reason I want to speak for, I just want to thank you for considering this, and especially, you know, that my heart is with the Parks Department. And I want to say thank you, and I hope that you guys consider future efforts to really try to improve what we already have. We have a great beginning now with the master plan, and I think we do need the money to really get into the master plan into action. One of the services that you guys help provide for parks, it is for our low-income families. You know, we have families that Parks Department, that is the only place that they can go, and we have those scholarships. And sometimes we don't think that, maybe we think it's just another department providing something. But you don't know when you have a family that it just can go and take their families, get a scholarship, and get them into the health. It really helps the whole family. So I just want you to not only think it's just a department that is providing an aquatic center or is just providing a spin class. You are helping to provide a healthy community, and we have to work together towards a healthy community. So when you do this and when you plan for the future, just think what it is that we want. We want a community that is healthy. We want a community that is integrated, that is inclusive. And for that, it's not all minorities are here in a way, because it's not about race, it's about income. And we don't have some of us that income to really pay for that, what we consider a luxury, just to go into the aquatic center and take a swim class, or to take just to lift those weights. So just please, in the future, I know a lot of cuts were made before. I think we have tried, as a member of the community, a part of that board, really to try to bring excellence into that department, because it brings excellence to the city. So just thank you, and I hope you guys really consider that it's much needed, and we can plan for a better future.
Thank you, Norma. Someone, anyone else? With that, I will close the public hearing, and now it's time for council discussion. I'm sure there will be some. You want to start on?
I can, if you like. Thank you, Norman. I think there's no question that Astoria has a robust, marvelous Parks and Recreation Department that we offer in a really comprehensive range of activities for young and old, for rich and poor alike, both indoor and outdoor activities and parks and child care, et cetera. It's terrific. And my understanding of this supplemental budget is it's not that anything really was added. When I came on council, one of the first few meetings that I had was with John Carlson. We went through the budget with Councilor Nimmowell, and I think we both had a couple of sessions with him, because that was the most important thing to understand, or one of the hardest things to understand. And we were told at that time that generally every year there is some amount of supplemental budget required for Parks and Recreation Department because of the basically the way the financial data is accrued. And so I have zero problem with this supplemental budget. It has been something, last year it was $180,000, this year it's a little higher. I know that Parks and Recreation and the Finance Department have been working towards better budgeting, closer budgeting to reality, and I encourage them to continue working towards that. I know it takes a long time, but I, and I've also had a number of conversations with City Manager Estes and with Susan Brooks, the Finance Director, about the need for at least quarterly real-time budget summaries so that department heads have a better idea of where they're at a given moment in time and can make adjustments or advise council as we go along, rather than having perhaps a big lump sum at the year end of the year. So I think it's not what the Parks Department is doing in terms of the services and activities that it provides, but the just the financial accounting. And I hope that we can make over the next year some really great strides towards getting that closer to actuality.
Councilor Neville-Will, would you like to weigh in?
Yes, thank you, Councilor Moore. excuse me, I think that this is evidence that Parks and Rec is just spread way too thin with the properties and services that we manage. We're going to need to make some tough choices about the places and programs that we value the most, because the way that we're operating is not sustainable. We must prioritize in order to keep vital services such as the Aquatic Center viable into the future. And I'd like to point out, in my opinion, this is by no means the fault of the current administration, the Parks Director, Angela Cosby. But too much was added a half decade ago before she came on board on the recreation and child care side. A lot of that recreation, those programs were added as money makers to the city, and I think that we see that that's not working. And we're going to need to partner with other organizations, perhaps recruit volunteers to take over some of these services. But I think that, you know, unfortunately, these are important conversations that we're not going to be able to ignore into the future.
And you're finished?
I'm done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I didn't know whether you were just pausing for breath or you were done. So thank you very much. And Councilor Herzig.
Thank you, Councilor Moore. I want to thank Ms. Hernandez for her remarks, reminding us to be inclusive in our planning for city departments, to remember people who might not be able to afford memberships and health clubs, that sort of thing. I'd like to extend that, piggybacking on that, to remind us about the same thing about our library. Families who cannot afford books, who cannot afford computers, internet access, magazines, journals, all those things that make a community healthy mentally as well as physically. So I think the reminder to be inclusive in our planning is very well taken, and I'd like to add that to say we need to think about that when we move forward with our library planning as well. So thank you, Mr. Hernandez.
And in my turn, I can't see in the budget where there is a lot of loose money to come to the aid of the Parks Department. And in my view, if we're not going to be able to substantially increase the budget, we've got to take a look at substantially limiting what we can do, and the things that we are able to do, we should do well. I think we have to take another look at the amount of park property that we're trying to maintain, the things that we're doing, taking care of the ball fields and that sort of thing, which is done in many communities by volunteers. So I think that we have to really sit down and set the priorities of what we want, but make sure what we want is sustainable into the future. And that conversation, thankfully, is probably going to come after my tenure, and That's okay. If the discussion is over, we could have a vote or a motion to approve the supplemental budget for fiscal year 2015-16.
I move we approve the supplemental budget for 2015-16.
Is there a second?
I'll second you.
Second.
Well, we have 2 seconds. Seconded first by Councilor Herzig. The motion was made by Councilor Price, and that takes a roll call. Kevin, would you be kind enough?
Absolutely. Councilor Herzig?
Aye.
Councilor Nemelo?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Ward?
Aye. And that carries. Next item is a resolution transferring appropriations within a fund, and that's the 17th Street Dock Fund. That's from the Finance Department.
Yes. And this is another budget adjustment. It includes the 17th Street Dock Fund as well as the Building Inspection Fund. And as with the earlier item for the General Fund, there's a need to be able to do adjustments on these individual funds of the City of Astoria. First of all, with regards to the 17th Street Dock Fund, at the time the budget was prepared, the actual amount of staff time required for work on that dock was not anticipated, and a transfer of $2,500 is required between the personal services and material services line items in the dock fund. These appropriations for personnel services in the amount of $2,500 are being transferred to provide appropriations in the total amount of $14,000. I would note that this was required as work was completed in the parking area of the 17th Street, parking area that provides parking for the users of the 17th Street dock, and this work required additional funds to be provided. With regards to the Building Inspection Fund, at the time the budget was originally prepared, the personal services included section of the budget included appropriations for a full-time building inspector and code enforcement officer. Then subsequently, the individual who was our building official at the time resigned, and the city then contracted those services out. A transfer is then required of $45,000 between the personnel services and moving that over to professional services, since those were contracted out. So what is recommended is that staff is recommended that council consider adoption of the resolution for both the 17th Street Dock Fund as well as the Building Inspection Fund.
Is there a motion?
This does not require a public hearing?
It does not, since it's not within there's a certain threshold that requires it. So.
I move that we adopt a resolution adopting transfer appropriations within a fund for the City of Astoria.
Is there a second?
Second.
Yes, and we'll have a, is that a roll call vote?
Yes, this will be a roll call vote.
Roll call vote. Chief, would you, you're chewing, never mind.
Councilor Herzig?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Nemelo?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Moore?
Aye. And that carries. Next item on the budget is item C, the Spur 14 Waterline Project.
So the goal of the Spur 14 Waterline Project is to provide a direct connection to the city's best water quality source up in the watershed. And upon completion, the project would provide better operational control over our water source selection. And there are some additional benefits which were identified in the memorandum. In May, the council authorized staff to bid the project, and following the competitive bids, we received 4 of those. Big River Construction provided the lowest responsive bid for the project in the amount of $286,007. And I would note that CH2 and Hill would be providing construction support services with regards to this project, and there would need to be a subsequent contract amendment with CH2 and Hill, which we presented to council at a subsequent meeting. But tonight, it's recommended that council authorize staff to award a construction contract to Big River Construction, and funds are available for the project within the next fiscal year budget, the fiscal year 16-17 budget.
So that was, the money has been budgeted for next year?
Yes, that is correct.
Do we have a motion to award the contract to Big River Construction?
So moved.
And second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
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 And the motion carries. Last item on the budget is our added item. It's an authorization to solicit proposals for a fuel system replacement project at the Public Works Department.
So the city currently uses a fuel delivery system for their vehicles, which is comprised of three underground fuel tanks. And this set of tanks is located at the Public Works Yard off of 30th Street. These three tanks were installed in 1978, and they're approaching or have exceeded the end of their service life. Replacing the existing fuel system with a new set of above-ground fuel tanks and updated components is the most cost-effective and sustainable way to continue to provide fuel for the City of Astoria fleet of vehicles. This system would include two new above-ground tanks. The existing tanks, as a part of this proposal, would be removed as a part of the project. As a part of the next fiscal year budget, a total amount of $220,000 was budgeted. So there would be money included in the next fiscal year capital improvement fund. We're looking at the time frame to be able to get this project completed this next fiscal year. And the reason why this item was requested to be added today is it was determined that to be able to meet that schedule, we would need to be able to get authorization to solicit proposals now and get moving on this project, as there's a lead time needed to be able to get the project bid and then also constructed. So tonight it's recommended that council authorize staff to solicit proposals for the fuel system replacement project.
We have a motion.
Some questions, please, Councilor Ward.
Okay.
I guess they're good. Ken, two questions, and they may end up canceling each other out. What arrangements would be made for some seismic reinforcement for these above-ground fuel tanks? And secondly, if the Public Works Department ever moves, would these be portable in a sense? Would you be able to take them and move them someplace else? So the more seismic you get, probably the less portable they are, but doesn't need those two things.
Ken, if you could use the microphone.
And answer your last question first. These tanks will be placed on a concrete foundation and bolted to the concrete foundation so that they don't slide off. By the same token, you undo the bolts, you can transport them somewhere else if need be.
First question about being seismic. We, at our emergency forum, we heard about liquefaction, and I'm not sure how much your cement slab might start sinking into the ground during that.
Jeff, you might want to speak to what we do.
Jeff Harrington, city engineer. I think the specification is going to require that they be, you know, strapped down and fastened down, but in terms of a foundation, for example, driving piles and doing something that would withstand a cascading event, I don't think that's cost effective. I think that could substantially increase the value and the cost of the project.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate the information. Thank you both. Thank you, Councilman.
Do you want to make a motion now?
I move the city authorize the solicitation of proposals for the fuel replacement system project.
Second. Been moved and seconded. There's no roll call. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And it passes unanimously. anyone from the audience want to address the council? Mr. Osher.
I'm David Osher, 254 West Irving, in Astoria. I just want to thank the councilors very, very much for your kind remarks about John Burtis. I am the chief financial officer of Grant 3. He has been, he will be greatly missed. He was an inspirational and a visionary leader. I do want to absolutely assure you that I will pass on these remarks to everyone in our company, and that John loved Astoria. We are absolutely as committed to Astoria as he was. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Is there anyone else? Well, that then, I think I'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.